esos niños sacrificando mi vida por huir de pobreza y violencia.
Edgar González es un migrante mexicano que se ha sumado al esfuerzo solidario con los niños migrantes centroamericanos.
Yo soy indocumentado. Yo migré aquí cuando yo tenía 9 años. Mis papás me trajeron aquí de México y pues es muy doloroso ver a gente adulta estar diciéndole a estos niños que son una enfermedad. Gente que nunca ha pasado por esto, diciéndole a los niños muchas cosas malas cuando los niños necesitan amor. Los niños necesitan compasión, vienen en busca de un mejor futuro, vienen en busca de sus padres. Ellos no entienden, estos niños vienen de sufrimiento, estos niños vienen de ser violados, estos niños han cruzado varias fronteras. Es muy doloroso verlos de que vienen aquí, ellos están sufriendo y los quieren mandar para atrás a la violencia.
González subraya que el papel que juega Estados Unidos en el desplazamiento de obreros y obreras es algo que ni los llamados analistas e investigadores parecen notar en sus estudios y comentarios a la prensa.
Este país siempre está involucrado en nuestros países. Yo soy mexicano, yo soy de Michoacán. Ahorita estamos enfrentando la guerra civil y mucha gente de Michoacán se quiere venir porque los Estados Unidos, es lo que no comentan, Obama acaba de dar a millones de armas a los carteles mexicanos. Este país está ayudando a la violencia en nuestros países. Va a nuestros países, pone sus factorías, nos dejan sin trabajo porque están entrando todas estas máquinas. Todo ahora es hecho por máquinas, nos quitan nuestros trabajos, están privatizando todo. Y pues estos niños se quedan sin nada.
Por su parte, el alcalde de la ciudad, Eric Garcetti, ha dejado claro que su gobierno está preparado a dar una mano solidaria a los niños centroamericanos.
La ciudad está dispuesta a asistir a los padres de estos niños. Algunos de ellos viven aquí.
Kevin DeLeon, presidente del Senado Estatal de California, admite que el tema de la migración es una cuestión polarizante, polémica y controvertida. Sin embargo, esos niños no son criminales ni sicarios o pandilleros y merecen más. Alejandra Valles forma parte del Sindicato Internacional de Empleados de Servicios. Ella insiste en que se puede dar la mano a los niños sin necesidad de intentar sacarle ganancias políticas al asunto.
Estamos todos tan enfocados en la política, en Obama, en el Congreso, en los republicanos, en el demócrata, en si va a pasar DACA, en la reforma, toda la política. Y se está perdiendo que son seres humanos, son niños, son familias que están huyendo de sus países, que están viniendo para acá porque están escapando, no porque quieren venir a Disneylandia.
El presidente Barack Obama visita Los Ángeles el jueves, donde ya los grupos defensores de los derechos humanos preparan una protesta frente al lugar donde estará el Ejecutivo. Ron Goches es integrante del grupo Unión del Barrio.
En estos instantes es súper importante que la comunidad salga a mandar un mensaje muy fuerte y claro al presidente Obama, que ahorita estamos exigiendo que él pare los ataques en contra de los niños. No solo los niños aquí que están deportando hacia Centroamérica, pero también los niños y ese pueblo palestino que está siendo masacrado en Palestina por un ejército en verdad terrorista de Israel, que lo está haciendo con el total apoyo económico y moral de los Estados Unidos. Y por eso creo que tenemos nosotros la responsabilidad en Los Ángeles de mandar ese mensaje que el presidente lo estamos denunciando por las deportaciones de niños inocentes y también por el apoyo a la masacre de los niños en Palestina. Y por eso invitamos a toda la comunidad mañana a las 12 de la tarde, al mediodía, a unirse con nosotros en la esquina de la calle Washington y Maple, enfrente de la escuela Santee High School. De ahí vamos a marchar hacia el colegio L.A. Trade Tech, donde se va a encontrar el presidente, donde va a dar un discurso.
Era Ron Goches del grupo Unión del Barrio, entidad que forma parte de la amplia gama de organizaciones que preparan la protesta del jueves. Ron Goches dice que personas interesadas pueden obtener más detalles sobre el evento buscándole en Facebook. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Soy una fábrica de humo, mano de obra campesina para tu consumo. Frente de frío en el medio del verano, el amor en los tiempos del cólera, mi hermano. Soy el que nace y el día que muere.
Estás escuchando el informativo Pacífica.
Puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblosinfronteras@gmail.com.
Los invitamos a visitar nuestra página blog en pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com, donde podrá opinar y encontrar más detalles sobre las noticias de Estados Unidos, América Latina y el mundo desde una perspectiva progresista.
Tiene mi bandera, la espina espina dorsal del planeta en mi cordillera. Soy lo que me enseñó mi padre. El que no quiere a su patria, no quiere a su madre. Soy América Latina, un pueblo sin pierna, pero que camina. Oye.
Gobiernos de América Latina continúan alejándose de la influencia política y la dependencia económica de Estados Unidos. El presidente de China culminó el miércoles en Cuba su visita por la región. Junto a su homólogo cubano firmaron decenas de proyectos conjuntos. Fabiola López, corresponsal de Telesur en La Habana, informa.
China pretende convertirse en uno de los principales inversionistas acá en Cuba y se firmaron acuerdos y convenios en prácticamente todos los sectores, en biotecnología, en petróleo, en níquel, en educación, en salud, en agricultura, en ganadería. También se pactaron líneas de crédito y financiamiento. Una de estas líneas de crédito para la parte cubana es precisamente esta que va a servir para la construcción de una terminal multipropósito en el puerto de Santiago de Cuba, que es el puerto Guillermo Moncada. Ha sido esta una visita que ya dicen los expertos que es una visita histórica, una visita estratégica, como también la que hizo Xi Jinping por los otros países de América Latina, y que es muy simbólica en el caso de Cuba, porque culmina esta gira precisamente por Cuba, que fue el primer país de América Latina que estableció relaciones diplomáticas con China en el año 1960.
Mientras el presidente de Venezuela, Nicolás Maduro, propuso fortalecer la alianza entre las cinco mayores economías emergentes del mundo, el grupo BRICS, y la Unión de Naciones Suramericanas, UNASUR.
Y acelerando muchos pasos, además, para que todo lo que discutimos con los presidentes de los BRICS tenga continuidad inmediata, no se quede en los discursos, sino que se pueda concretar una alianza entre el Banco de BRICS y el Banco del Sur. Una alianza de trabajo entre el Fondo de Reserva de BRICS y el Fondo de Reservas de Sudamérica que hay que crear.
En conferencia de prensa, Maduro aseguró que el grupo BRICS y UNASUR impulsan la creación de bancos de desarrollo regional para no recurrir más a los impopulares Fondo Monetario Internacional y Banco Mundial.
Las cinco economías emergentes más poderosas del siglo XXI han creado dos mecanismos clave que van a crear las condiciones de un nuevo sistema financiero internacional. Las van a crear y van a obligar a lo que en esos escenarios del Fondo Monetario y del Banco Mundial llaman una reforma del sistema. Lo van a obligar. Así no quieran el Fondo Monetario y el Banco Mundial, tendrán que reformarse para bien, si es que se puede hacer alguna reforma para bien de esos dos organismos, porque son dos organismos creados para ejercer la hegemonía del capital financiero estadounidense y del capital financiero de algunos países de Europa sobre el mundo.
El presidente de Venezuela, Nicolás Maduro, anunció que el jueves darán inicio las transmisiones de Telesur en inglés.
Lo mío es tuyo, este pueblo no se ahoga con marullo, y si se derrumba, yo lo reconstruyo, tampoco me extrañeo cuando...
La presidenta de Argentina reiteró el miércoles que su país no entrará en default porque no ha dejado de pagar su deuda externa, dijo. Cristina Fernández recordó que un juez estadounidense ordenó a un banco neoyorquino no aceptar los pagos que Argentina hace al 92% de sus acreedores internacionales que negociaron la deuda de la nación suramericana.
¿Pero saben por qué no vamos a estar en default? Porque en default entran los que no pagan. Y Argentina pagó. Así que...
El juez Tomás Griesa quiere obligar a Argentina a pagar más de 1.300 millones de dólares a fondos especuladores. Los llamados fondos buitre compraron bonos basura de la deuda y no aceptaron negociar con Argentina.
Los gurúes, los académicos, siempre encuentran algún término con el cual disfrazar lo que realmente pasa, pero van a tener que encontrar un nuevo término que refleje que un deudor pagó y alguien bloqueó y no deja de llegar ese dinero. Es de terceros a esos terceros que son los tenedores del canje del 2005.
El próximo 31 de julio se cumple la fecha límite para que Argentina abone a sus acreedores. El pago anterior fue bloqueado por Griesa. En El Salvador, organizaciones ambientales piden al Congreso una ley que prohíba la minería metálica.
Nuevamente, las organizaciones medioambientales se pronuncian para exigir a la Asamblea Legislativa aprueben con prontitud una ley contra la explotación de la minería metálica en El Salvador, en el marco del Día Mundial contra la Megaminería. El representante de los Aliados Internacionales contra la Minería Metálica, Pedro Cabezas, también considera que esta actividad no tiene viabilidad económica ni ambiental, debido a que estas industrias afectarían los cultivos a causa de la contaminación del agua y el daño provocado en los suelos.
Nosotros creemos que es posible parar la minería. Necesitamos que el gobierno pase una ley en contra de la minería en El Salvador, donde claramente se diga que las corporaciones mineras no están permitidas acá, y necesitamos que la población en general siga en pie de lucha para mantener el moratorio, que eventualmente se va a convertir en ley, y no solo eso, sino que comenzar a implementar políticas de sostenibilidad ambiental para que el futuro de El Salvador se asegure para las futuras generaciones.
Por su parte, el miembro de la Mesa Nacional frente a la Minería, Bernardo Belloso, manifiesta que trabajan junto a las ordenanzas municipales para crear zonas libres de explotación minera y asegura que los esfuerzos los realizan en colaboración con otros organismos internacionales.
Tenemos grandes efectos negativos y de impactos ambientales en el territorio salvadoreño. También hemos tenido muerte de líderes y lideresas que han defendido su territorio, sus recursos, a causa, por supuesto, de las empresas mineras. Y esto en su momento también hemos hecho esas denuncias a nivel nacional y a nivel internacional sobre esas conflictividades que las empresas mineras generalizan o realizan en los territorios.
Asimismo, la habitante de una de las comunidades afectadas, Vidalina Morales, manifiesta que la presencia de la empresa minera y sus estragos en estas zonas son visibles. Por esta razón, considera urgente que los diputados agilicen la aprobación de una ley que proteja el territorio que es casa de todos.
Nosotros como país, como comunidades afectadas también, estamos alzando nuestra voz y uniéndonos a esas voces que rechazan estos proyectos que atentan contra la vida, contra la dignidad, contra la soberanía de los pueblos y contra la decisión de los habitantes de las comunidades y, por supuesto, de los habitantes de un país.
La Mesa Nacional frente a la Minería y los Aliados Internacionales impulsan una campaña para denunciar a la compañía Pacific Rim e instar a los tribunales internacionales a tomar una resolución a favor de la soberanía del territorio para que el Estado promueva políticas en bien del pueblo salvadoreño.
En Guatemala se está pidiendo claridad sobre quién regulará las consultas comunitarias sobre temas importantes. Carolina Rivas con la información.
Existe cierto debate sobre quién debe regular las consultas comunitarias de buena fe. La OIT, la Organización Internacional del Trabajo, ha recomendado que para nuestro país sea el Ministerio de Trabajo quien regule dichas consultas, a lo que organizaciones sociales se oponen. Escuchamos a Daniel Pascual del Comité de Unidad Campesina CUC.
La OIT quiere poner una camisa de fuerza en donde las consultas deben ser promovidas desde el Ministerio de Trabajo o desde las municipalidades o el Tribunal Supremo Electoral, cuando este derecho es un derecho consuetudinario, que Guatemala sí está poniendo prueba también a las Naciones Unidas y a la OIT misma, referente a si respetan y defienden y hacen valer los derechos de pueblos indígenas establecidos en estos convenios y tratados, o permiten que se vulnere y que se violente por los mismos gobiernos, estados nacionales y por las empresas transnacionales.
En Guatemala se han realizado 84 consultas comunitarias de buena fe amparadas en el convenio 169 de la OIT, que manda a los estados a informar a la población sobre cualquier proyecto que se trabaje en su territorio. Sin embargo, aunque nuestro país ratificó el convenio, este no se respeta, según Daniel Pascual.
Con los últimos tres gobiernos ha habido un retroceso de la mano del modelo extractivo minero, petrolero, hidroeléctrico, a partir de vulnerar principalmente esos derechos, el derecho de libre determinación de los pueblos.
Las organizaciones sociales aducen que si se les consulta, el Congreso de la República podría generar una propuesta para regular las consultas comunitarias de buena fe, reportó Carolina Rivas.
Continúan las multitudinarias movilizaciones en todo el mundo pidiendo detener la masacre de palestinos y castigar a Israel.
Y esto es todo en español y entonces en inglés. In English, it is time for Bathrop Spears broadsides. We won't be covering the latest round of Israeli murders in the West Bank and Gaza, but We are going to focus on local civil rights violations. We have a couple guests coming into the studio, so stay with us on this July 24th, 2014 edition of Bathrobs, Piers, Broadsides.
All around this country, trouble in the air, and I hear the voices calling me, asking, do you know and do you care? Do you know and do you care? So I'm gonna do what I have to do, say what I have to say, and I'm gonna be what I have to be. Now won't you come on along with me? Won't you come along with me? Don't wanna cause no sorrow, don't wanna cause no pain. Oh, I'm only gonna talk what I have to talk, until this land is free of shame, till this land is free of shame. So I'm gonna do what I have to do, say what I have to say, and I'm gonna be what I have to be. Now won't you come on along with me, won't you come along with me? Only one thing I know we're not alone. Was a million here before we came, be a million when we're gone, we're gone, million when we're gone. So I'm gonna do what I have to do, say what I have to say, and I'm gonna be what I have to be. Now won't you come on along with me, won't you come along with me? Oh, I'm afraid of trouble, yes, I'm afraid of jail, but I'm more afraid for not to try, more afraid what happens now if we fail, what happens now if we fail. So I'm gonna do what I have to do, say what I have to say, and I'm gonna be what I have to be. Now won't you come on along with me, won't you come along with me?
And that's an ancient Phil Oakes tune, I'm Gonna Do What I Have to Do. Could be playing a few more of those from an old tape that was passed on to me by Santa Cruz local street singer, and actually played more in the clubs and on gig than on the streets, Mark Levy. But he also composed some songs for Santa Cruz, specifically fighting the sitting ban, called There Ain't No Sitting in the City of Santa Cruz. And he had another one, the ballad of Sandra Loringer, about the woman who was spent a month in jail for serving free food in Santa Cruz in 1989, along with a bunch of us who essentially broke the feeding ban at that time by refusing to be intimidated by Mayor Wormhout's police force. She was the liberal, progressive mayor of her day, who was anything but with regard to homeless and poor people. So, welcome to Bathrobs, Spears, Broadsides. We're going to be playing a lot of tapes, and we're going to be also interviewing a few live folks. We're going to be covering the last shitty council meeting. That was Tuesday, day before yesterday. And kind of be rolling through a lot of interviews right before the city council meeting at the homeless meal that happens every Monday at the Red Calvary Episcopal Church. And service is presided over by our Father Joel Miller, and that'll be coming up too. In the studio with me is a guy who's going to belly up to the mic because he can't really be heard unless you're about an inch away from the microphone. And what's your name, sir?
My name is Chris.
And I'll call you Chris. How's that?
That's fine.
I know we ran into each other at the Huff meeting, you and two of your associates, and you, how long have you been in Santa Cruz?
Right about a week, I would say 6 days.
And are you an old-timer here? Have you been here before?
This is actually my first time on the West Coast, but it is my 34th state, counting D.C.
Oh, wow. So you've been doing the tour, so to speak.
I have. I travel on and off. I was pretty well raised traveling my entire life, actually.
And what were the last few cities that you were at?
Well, I spent about a month in Colorado with my sister, and then took off and went up to Wyoming, up 287, and ended up getting a ride that was supposed to take me to Berkeley, but in 2 days it took me to Sparks, and he kind of changed his destination a little. And so I got a Megabus ticket and got into San Francisco, and then hitched it on down this way.
And you made it here. What brought you to Santa Cruz? Why come to here?
I was just told by people it's a good place to check out if I want to see some of the good of California.
Uh-huh. You told that it was a wonderful paradise where homeless people loll about in the streets, eating grapes and drinking wine.
Something equivalent to that, yeah.
Really? So you were told that? I've often regarded that as mythological. So you were told that the laws regarding homeless people in public places was different here than elsewhere, was more liberal? Or?
I wasn't specifically told that, but I did ask the question of a number of people that had been here, and I don't think that when any of them had traveled through here, it was as strict as it is now. I am under the impression that the laws have recently been tightened.
Well, they've been... Yeah, in some respects that's true. In other respects, it's as bad as it was. The laws have been bad for 2 decades, three or four decades if you want to look at the sleeping ban, which has been in force in its current form since 1978. And actually, I was doing some research I'd done years ago. The original sleeping ban law, or the granddaddy of the sleeping ban law, was 1967. But the current ordinance really reached its, thou shalt not sleep after 11 o'clock at night, thou shalt not cover up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night. Thou shalt not set up a campsite with the intention to remain overnight any time. That was established in 1978. But they've been around for a while. The laws about sitting next to a building it's been illegal to sit next to a building, even on the extremely wide sidewalks of Santa Cruz on Pacific Avenue, since 1994.
Wow.
And so it's been around for quite a time, but it's gotten worse.
Has the enforcement changed, do you think? Or?
Well, it's interesting. Enforcement has recently gotten laxer because they tightened the laws so much that it provoked a response, not as much of a response as I'd hoped, resistance, but it became obvious that there was less than 1% of the sidewalk was available for vending, political tabling, sitting, spare changing, performing. Most of the sidewalk, as you may have probably have noticed, is taken up with either sidewalk cafes and privatized areas, various obstructions of different kinds, a few benches. I mean, that's nice to have benches. But around each of these items, usually, with the exception of bike racks and parking meters and street lamps, which don't have the 14-foot, thou shalt not sit within 14 feet of us, is there are 14-foot forbidden zones around almost everything on Pacific Avenue, which means there's very little place to be. Right. And so most of the people you see out there doing their thing are doing it illegally, and the police are kind of not paying much attention to it unless they selectively choose to go after it, which they do whenever they feel like it.
What's actually more interesting to me, there are, in fact, zones. There are three zones in specific that are allowed for busking. But what's more interesting to me is that some of the people that live in houses and have jobs and can afford to rent a spot out for a certain time are then allowed to tell whoever is there to leave. And so, you know, and I don't want to completely come across.
Wait a minute.
What are
you talking about? The privatized cafe areas, or what are you talking about?
I'm not sure who handles the.
Everyone has access to the public sidewalk in theory,
right?
Equally, and there are no three zones you mentioned. Unless you know, I'm not sure what you're talking about. There are so-called the
exempt zones. Is the terminology.
Well, there is a word exempt zone, which has to do with you can be within 14 feet of something, but you still have to move every hour.
Right.
That's and a very small area.
You can't come back to the same spot in 24 hours.
That's
right.
Correct. In right. front of the book, you have to move 100 feet. So it means, in essence, it makes it very difficult to find places to be.
There's only three spots.
If basically. You want to follow the laws, but they don't really seem to care if you follow the laws until such time as they decide to focus on you, then they care a great deal. So it's really kind of a police state situation in Santa Cruz where the you know, you might regard it as a benevolent police state if the police like you. But if they don't, or if you're doing stuff that they find uncomfortable, or if you challenge their authority in some ways, or if they just, you know, got a burr under their saddle, then you're in trouble. Yeah, there are two zones that are supposedly exempt from the 14-foot setback area, but only around the statues that are there. One of them is front of O'Neill's and across from the Cinema 9. The other is in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, or the bookshop Coonerty, as I call it, since the Coonerty family owns the bookshop and has been instrumental in helping to make these laws worse, even though they have a bookshop, which originally was seen as a great liberal bastion in Santa Cruz. So what's the third zone that you found?
I actually have only really bust at the statue and at O'Neill's, but there are three locations. They have a pamphlet, actually. If you're busking downtown,
the
people
pamphlet.
In yellow shirts will offer to give you, and it tells you the three exempt locations on there.
I'm not sure of any such third location. But
that's just according to the pamphlet.
I'd like to see it.
It actually maybe mentions the same location twice, which is O'Neill's, because it mentions that intersection, I believe. That's actually, come to think of it, I did read it, and I remember that revelation now. Now that two of the three
locations. Me, this doesn't mean anything because the sidewalks are public and you should be able to use them for whatever purpose you need to, unless you're engaging in something that's abusive to the public weal or, you know, injurious to people or blocking their way. And this sort of notion, and it's acquired some unfortunate, not legitimacy, but acceptability because it's been repeated so often. I mean, you're saying it. Oh, see, I got those three zones you can busk in, or two zones. You know, it's ridiculous. The sidewalk
is
where you busk.
The thing is that the people walking by enjoy my presence because I'm positive and I'm a juggler. You know, there's not a whole lot of us in the world, and it's not something they get to see every day. There's not someone in town that does what I do every day in Santa Cruz. That's a fact.
So how many hours a day, Chris, are you juggling on the sidewalk?
Consistently since I've started, 3 to 8 hours a day, every single day. Today, about 5 hours, to make a paltry sum, as it were.
And how's it going? And where have you been juggling?
Mostly at O'Neill's. I was going down to the wharf, but I don't like the drunk and drug crowd that's down there. Honestly, I think it's a more positive crowd in the downtown area.
And have you had, what kind of a reception have you had from the hosts, police, and security guards?
I've had some negative and I've had some positive. Today, I actually had somewhat of a positive experience because I've actually had the unfortunate experience of running off some of the undesirable, drunk, and drugged-out people who were violent in their mannerisms. You know, I've had to run several of them off. Well, today I had a drunk guy. He wasn't being particularly violent, so, you know, I was just kind of dealing with him, and the downtown security folks actually ran him off. And then I started making money again, because, of course, when a drunk guy is sitting next to me, clearly being drunk and drinking, you know, it's pretty hard to make any money.
So they didn't tell you to move every hour, as they have the option to do.
They don't really enforce that on me. I've actually in my travels around the country, and you know, this is not the only place where they're harassing the homeless and doing unreasonable things and cracking down. It's kind of a national trend actually right now. But I will say that generally police are more lenient towards me because of what I do, and because it's not common. Than someone who's holding a sign or panhandling, you know.
What have you seen in terms of people actually, how police are treating other people downtown?
Well, when I first came here, I was traveling with a couple other kids my age, and one of them played guitar, and they were not very receptive to that. He was pretty much constantly harassed the entire time that we were around each other, so we would be at two separate spots because, of course, there's an ordinance that, even though I juggle, the two of us being next to each other would make it a ban, which is just ridiculous. But so we would split up in different parts of the wharf, and he would be harassed almost constantly, and never once would the police say anything to me. If anything, they would watch and say that they liked my juggling, and so I'm enjoying kind of
Is he a bad guitarist? Is he out of tune?
He's actually pretty good. I've listened to him for a while. I mean, he's not, you know, Jimi Hendrix here or anything, but he's played for 12 or 13 years, and, you know, I a lot of people have enjoyed him. You know,
What's
he keeps
name?
Crowds of people Oso.
Oso?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he didn't come to the Huff meeting yesterday with
no,
you.
No, he wasn't there yesterday.
Has he been driven away, or is he still playing?
I think he's still down there, but part of the reason we split up is, again, that I really don't like the drunk crowd down by the wharf, because as a traveler, I feel responsible for the image that people have of my family, my traveling family around the country. I've been doing this as an adult for about 6 years and did it as a child for a large portion of my childhood. And, you know, it's something I take seriously, and I don't want to be associated with the negative elements, you know.
Now, are you indoors or outdoors at night, or are you one of them criminal sleeper guys?
Been outdoors. You know, I get housed up fairly frequently, but not in the last 4 or 5 days.
And have you experienced any problems around that?
Definitely gotten some harassment over that.
Tell me about that.
Well, one morning we had just laid down, maybe 4 in the morning, got an hour or so of sleep, and park ranger told us we were in off-access area of the park. That was the one ticket I've actually got here in town. Now, that is a little more reasonable because there were signs posted. We didn't see them because it's nighttime and they're hidden in the brush and the trees. They're not particularly visible at nighttime, but regardless, it was a restricted area. Other than that, we've had police...
Did they tell you there was an unrestricted area you could go to?
They did. However,
really?
In giving you a ticket in the park, they also ban you from the park for 24 hours. So
they said there was an area in the park you could go to and sleep 24 hours later?
24 hours later. Well, they did not say that I could sleep there. They said that I could be there during the day. Which, apparently, the interesting thing about Santa Cruz is that it's perfectly legal to sleep in a park during the day. It's just you're not allowed to sleep at nighttime. That is forbidden.
That's correct.
It's all for your own good, son. We're trying to increase meth sales. If
they are. I think, you know, and I notice a very large portion of the homeless here rely on methamphetamine just to survive. Because I think, I'm not saying that their addiction is responsible for that, but I think it definitely encourages that lifestyle. And it's impossible to ignore that fact.
So what about the general population? How are they responding to your juggling activities?
Pretty positively. I gather some large crowds. I've had a couple people leave their kids with me. I feel sometimes like a babysitter. It's been worse at like festivals and things like that, but I'll just have a whole circle of kids, and I want to leave, and I have to be like, where are your parents, guys? I'm, you know, not responsible for
you. How much money do you make a day on this kind of activity?
Precious, precious little.
Really?
Today I made, from somewhere between 4 and 5 hours of juggling, I made about $20. No food kickdowns.
And so what you get out of this is a spiritual sustenance. What do you get out of this?
Well, I mean, obviously, physically and mentally juggling develops you in a way that very few things do. It actually raises your IQ significantly and blah, blah, blah. We won't even go into the medical science behind
juggling.
Really?
Never heard of that.
There's definitely a spiritual element to it, you know, it's also about my future, because anywhere that I go in the world, I can travel and I can make money doing what I do. I also do hand balancing, which I did today. And so, you know, the thing is, though, is that I'm having the same experience here in California that I had in Colorado, because these are states that traveling kids have kind of flocked to because of the legal status of marijuana and because of the ready availability of other hard drugs also. And the term is that it's blown up. You know, it's really blown up. Nobody really wants to see any street kid. No matter how pleasant and friendly you are, no matter what you're providing to the community, most people just kind of ignore you. You know, people's kids will stop and start watching me, and their parents will get angry at them and yell at them and drag them away because they stopped to watch the homeless person. You know, for every person that I've had be very positive and very welcoming of what I do, there's been maybe 2 or 3 more that have not felt that way in any way whatsoever. And, so, you know, but there's a certain element of that anywhere that you go. That's not just here in Santa Cruz, you know. A lot of people don't approve of my lifestyle, and I really don't care.
Well, are you intending to stay for a while, Chris, or are you moving on? What's your feeling?
Well, you know, I'm meaning to get moving out of here as soon as I can. The person that I'm going to be traveling with, I found a gentleman a little older than me that's a little more intellectual. He's a little more calmed down, and I feel better traveling with him than with some people my age, and he has some things he's getting done, changing addresses and such, before we'll be ready to go. So we'll probably be here all day tomorrow, but I'm hoping the next day to actually finally leave.
Mm-hmm. You wandered into the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting yesterday. What brought you there? Did you just happen to see it? It was in the Anarchist Sub Rosa Cafe, where we are every Wednesday.
Actually, I stopped because I saw the Sub Rosa and it said it was an anarchist cafe. Mm-hmm. Now, I have what I use as my journal for the last couple of years is called The Slingshot, which is an anarchist publication out of Berkeley. And in the back, it lists several hundred anarchist locations around the country, everything from bike shops to zine libraries to coffee shops like that one, quite frequently the coffee shops. And so I like to actually check these off as I travel, as I've been politically involved for my entire adult life now, and usually meet interesting people that have the same kind of thoughts that I do. So we kind of all like to be around our own.
And how did the scene yesterday measure up?
You know, I can't say it was particularly any different than it would be in any other place that I've been, either in a meeting or to a scene like that. You know, this is pretty well what I would expect, you know.
And one of the things we're trying to do here, some of us, is to change the police practices and laws, and also essentially to mobilize people to get together to essentially stand up for themselves and their rights. Have you seen this happening in any other cities? What have you seen here around this?
And again, you know, the thing is, even though Santa Cruz may have some of the worst laws on homelessness that I've encountered, they are not by any measure the only city that traveling people have kind of flocked to that has those kind of ordinances and is fighting a war on the homeless. Again, this is a national issue. This isn't a local issue in Santa Cruz. And I would say that there's not a lot going on nationwide. I mean, there were some things that went on during Occupy. You know, in Florida, Gainesville, I believe, they got the police to stop harassing the homeless there because Florida is one of the worst states in bankruptcy. I've never even actually been into the state of Florida because it is so bad that I don't want to, and which is what they want. So, you know, they're winning by me not going into Florida is the thing about that. And I have a right to be there as an American. You know, I have a right to see my country. But that being said, I don't think that the state of things is that different here than in anywhere else that I've been. And in saying that, you know, that's an average. There's extreme examples where something's been done and they've changed things. And there's also places where people are very intolerant of the homeless. In the South, you know, there's still a lot of racism, and it's the vast majority of the homeless population.
There's a lot of racism
South.
In the North as well.
Right. Well, it's more pronounced in the South. It's like socially acceptable to make racist comments in a large group of black people.
What states have you been through?
Well, I've been in every state on the eastern side of the country except for Florida and the New England states, and I've been in a lot of the states. I've been in the entire Midwest and the entire South, and I've been like Wyoming and Nebraska and Utah and all of that. I haven't actually been in any state touching the West Coast except for California. Uh-huh. This is the only state touching the West Coast I've been on.
So you have your work cut out for you.
I do. And a good friend.
But what about resistance? That's what it was. I wasn't asking about, you know, oppression, which is unfortunately everywhere, but it's asking about resistance. What have you seen in terms of resistance? Because you are checking out anarchist cafes, bookstores, bike shops, so forth.
Well, you know, I what I've seen more of is the spirit of gathering strength. Everyone wants a few more people to help them out, and nobody really feels empowered to actually do anything. That's what I feel like. People are disenfranchised because, to be frank, all the successes that the Occupy movement had, it was by and large a failure. And, you know, part of the reason you wanted me to come here today was to talk about the 8 cities that I did Occupy in during the time that was actively going on in my involvement with the National Lawyers Guild and all of that stuff. And all of that being said, and all of the work, you know, 6 months of my life, pretty much every waking minute was somehow involved in Occupy, you know. I gave up everything for that, and I feel like it was kind of a lie at the end because, you know, I spent a large portion of that 6 months in New York City, which was supposed to be kind of the heart of it, you know, and I met some people that I won't mention here that were involved in some of the online things, you know, and I've seen quite a bit, honestly, and at the end of the day, everybody's really just worried about what affects them. Nobody's seeing the big picture. We're not getting, we've lost the spirit of our forefathers because we've forgotten what it was like to be truly oppressed. And our government has such a hold on people's minds and their spirits that they sort of convince people that this is actually the nicest place in the world to live, when in fact our quality of life rating is like 17th in the world or something like that. You know, this is absolutely not the nicest place in the world to live. And anybody who says so is, in fact, brainwashed and indoctrinated, in my opinion.
Now, have you been to other places that you find that are nicer?
I have not actually got to leave the States myself yet.
So you are speaking theoretically or through secondhand accounts?
I am through secondhand accounts, yes.
So in other words, you're a dirty traitor who's believing commie propaganda.
And, well, and also I think that those statistics are not everything. They do exist for a reason. And saying that we have the 17th quality of life rating in the world when we're supposed to be, you know, this great pinnacle of
yeah, but
life.
What does that mean? I mean, who I'm not sure. You're
quality drawing... of life is based largely off of the price of food against the income and the cost of rent and how high, like, health issues are. So, like, you know, we have a lot of obesity and cancer here, and that really drives our rating down. It's based off a whole amalgamation of things, you know. It's a really generalized and useless statistic, but I think it actually does represent something, which is that what people call living here in America does not pass in a lot of places. What we call living here is going to a job to pay for a house that you barely spend any time in, and in a car that you only use to get to and from work, and then watching television and having the television tell you how to think when you're not at work. And we eat crap food that has virtually nothing in it. Macronutrients of any kind, just your basic carbohydrate and protein, and it's
no decent holidays.
Yeah, it's no decent holidays. Yeah,
mm-hmm. No decent time off.
No decent time.
Okay,
off.
We have a voice in the corner, as usually, without introducing himself and sitting off to the side, far away from a microphone, but simply spitting out words that people can't hear. Let me introduce. It's Dr. Michael O'Grady, who. Seems to forget he is in a radio station where, and not simply in a conversational bull session. So pull up a mic, pull up a chair if you want to be a part of this, or shut up. One of the two, it's my feeling. Sorry, folks. Mike, I get to kick around a lot. He's a sweet guy. Let me do that. Turn up your mic, Mike. Let me ask you, before we go into the Occupy history, which I think you may have mentioned it, but that wasn't, I don't know if that was the main reason I asked you here, although I'm interested in that. Did I tell you that was the main reason
No, you told me you wanted to hear that story and you wanted me to tell it on this show. I think that
sure.
we went on into the homeless stuff and the concerns in Santa Cruz with the homeless policies, and I think that became the main drive in inviting me here. But you had originally mentioned interest in the Occupy.
Yeah, no, thing. We can talk about that too. Mike, however, here does. His accommodations are in the Homeless Lack of Service Center's Paul Lee Loft, which I understand you have to pay for. I hadn't even realized that. You are paying to be there in the loft, right, Mike?
Yeah. They take a certain amount of money. I think it's around $300 from your Social Security check. And so I'll be there for a few more days. Then my 30-day term is up.
I mean, in a way, $10 a night is not very much, although the quality of the accommodations may leave something to be desired.
Yeah, I mean, I don't eat there, and because...
Well, the $10 covers food every day?
Yeah, it does.
And if you come, you can eat there if you don't stay there without paying $10. In other words, if you stand in line for the breakfast and dinner.
Yeah, exactly. You don't actually pay there, but they just deduct the money from your Social Security check.
So are they requiring you to send your Social Security check to this private organization, the Homeless Lack of Services Center?
No. Whatever money they transfer to your bank account will be $300 less. If you stay,
well, wait a minute.
You
why you're saying you send your money through them? Don't you get your money at a bank somewhere else?
Yeah, I do. I get my money.
They
in my
ask
bank.
For access to your bank account.
No, they fill the form out and they inform the central people who write the checks how much you're going to get every month.
So in other words, they short circuit you. They're actually going to your money source and deducting the money from your check.
Yeah.
And you're signing some agreement that that's okay.
Yeah.
How many people in the loft are actually kicking down this money to fund this homeless lack of services?
There's only the people that are over 65 will receive Social Security checks. There are other people there younger getting something like SSI or disability checks of some kind.
Do you have any sense of how many that is?
No, I do not. I do not know that.
We should get that kind of statistic.
But I do know there are people there who don't get any money.
Do you have any sense of what percentage of the people actually pay and what percentage are there without paying?
I have no idea about that.
I expect a full report by next Sunday.
If I was to guess, I'd say 50-50. That's just a wild guess.
If you can't ask at the, if you don't think they'll kick you out for asking, ask at the
I could ask. I'll be leaving anyway in a few days.
Okay. And I know I've also encouraged you to try to get the documentation of your application form that would allow the police to, when you show it to them after they roused you for sleeping, as they did to you, Chris, one night, say, wait, hold it, you can't rouse me, I'm on the waiting list of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. Kind of strange that people who are on a private organization's waiting list can be exempted from a public law. You know, I find that, a sort of... I mean, it's good if everyone has access to that list, but the question is, do they? I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, again, talking about like national trends, the privatization of homeless shelters and the industries that feed them and the funding that's given to them by the government is another serious national trend. And it's one that I do find relatively disturbing, because generally I would say that the output of those places does not match what is being given to them. They're always fairly generous with their salaries at the top. That's kind of a trend. Also,
you're not saying Monica Martinez is making lots. Actually, she's gone now. She's moved up to Encompass, the other organization.
Mm-hmm.
She can suck some money out of. No, I mean I'm sure that's true. I mean the privatization has become all the rage, and is also a way of breaking the power of people who are trying to unite to assure a more equitable distribution, get people instead competing with each other and clambering over each other, but. The issue for me is you should, to require freedom from unconstitutional sleeping ban laws to be based on your ability to please the Homeless Lack of Services Center and get on their waiting list is obviously unconstitutional, because you should not, it can't be up to them whether you're exempted from a law or not. I mean, that's simply wrong. And that's been the case for 4 years in Santa Cruz. The problem is, if you complain about it, this whole law was created because of protests in what was called Peace Camp 2010, a year before the Occupy movement started, where a bunch of us began sleeping out in front of the county building every night, and Ed Fry, an activist lawyer, was sleeping with us there, supplied a porta potty. I was only there for a week, and after that I was reporting on the situation. And in order to, and many people flocked there and began sleeping there because there was no legal place for people to sleep. There's like the Pauley Loft then, as now, only had 46 spaces for people. And you have, 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people in the city at least. And there's other estimates have been larger. So in order to deal with that, 2 months after it started, a month after they crushed it, they put in a law that stated, you can always avoid the sleeping ban by getting on a waiting list of the Pauley Loft or the River Street Shelter, both of which are private organizations.
Are these private organizations funded by the city of Santa Cruz?
Well, they receive some funding from the city, the state, the federal government, and private donors, as I understand it. And then, frankly, I should have that information in front of me, and I don't. At some point, I may, and I'd like to know what the percentages are, as I say, of people who, I don't know how much they're sucking out of welfare and disability checks for this kind of thing, because I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong for to require some kind of support by the people living there, but landlords have certain requirements. Shelters seem to have much less in the way of requirements. In fact, and I don't know, because I have only a vague recollection having read this, but it seemed to me that shelters actually only developed at the end of the 70s, instead of dealing with providing, adequate rental and housing for people, although there was advances in housing then that we don't see anymore, they decided instead to suspend habitability laws to allow these massive shelters to happen, which some might say, that's good, then people can go indoors. Yeah. But in the meantime, you have vacant buildings galore that could be used as real shelters and should be used, and they're simply in the hands of profiteering real estate speculators and banks. And that's, of course, been the case for the last 45 years, and that was one of the big issues in the Occupy movement as well. I'm going to get back to the Occupy movement. First, let's hear that old-time singer, Phil Oakes, sing some old-time chanties that you may not have heard before, unless anybody wants to say anything before we leave. If you want to call in, you can, 427-3772. That's the phone number here, 831-427-3772. 3772. Give us a call, and you can talk to Chris, Michael, or me, or the world, because, hey, we're going out over the air.
When the river of rebellion overflows, I'll be there. When the seed of discontent plants and grows, I'll be there. Watching for the sun through the dark and rainy storm. Searching for the keys to the dungeons old and worn. Let me tell you, I'll be there. When the shadow of the tyrant falls and sweeps across the land. And when men would steal from others with a paper in their hands. When people search for answers and the answers never come. When their troubles would be over if they thought and fought as one. Oh, let me tell you, I'll be there. The whispering of yesterday has grown into a roar. Wind of freedom's blowing out of every distant shore. Oh, when the time is ready and the call is loud and clear, let me tell you, I'll be there. When the thunder of oppression roars and crackles, I'll be there. And when those who would be free are wearing shackles, I'll be there. For the day is gonna come when they'll throw away their chains, lift their heads and raise their arms for the struggle that remains. And let me tell you, I'll be there. Whispering of yesterday has grown into a roar. Wind of freedom's blowing out of every distant shore. Oh, when the time is ready and the call is loud and clear, let me tell you, I'll be there. When the thunder of oppression roars and crackles, I'll be there. And when those who would be free are wearing shackles, I'll be there. For the day is gonna come when they'll throw away their chains, lift their heads and raise their arms for the struggle that remains. And let me tell you, let me tell you, let me tell you, let me tell you, I'll be there. I'll sing you a song about a southern town where the devil had his rule. When marshals faced an angry mob to send one man to school. His name was Jimmy Meredith, and the tide he helped to turn. For he chose to stay that terrible day, the land was soon to learn. There was blood, red blood on their hands, yellow dirt on their clothes. What they thought they were doing, only God and the devil know. There was hate, cold hate in their hearts, shot from their souls like a gun. And as they threw their stones and bricks, they screamed, see what you have done. The governor made a promise he would keep the trouble down. But when the mob got ugly, no troopers could be found. And men were filled with hate and fear, they screamed into the night. The rebel flag waved in the air, the symbol of state's rights. There was blood, red blood on their hands, yellow dirt on their clothes. What they thought they were doing, only God and the devil know. There was hate, cold hate in their hearts, shot from their souls like a gun. And as they threw their stones and bricks, they screamed, see what you have done. Gas was fired into the mob after each attack. And though the gas was running low, they never fired back. And when the smoke had cleared away and the fury felt its pain, two men were dead and 100 fled. The South had risen again. So listen, Mr. Barnett and Mr. Walker, too. The times are changing mighty fast, they'll roll right over you. But someday you'll head farther south to the southern tip of hell. And it's hot down there, white hot down there, let's hear your rebel yell. There was blood, red blood on their hands, yellow dirt on their clothes. What they thought they were doing, only God and the devil know. There was hate, cold hate in their hearts,
shot from their souls like a gun. And as they threw their stones and bricks, they screamed, "See what you have done. See what you have done."
And that was two by Phil Oakes from a much earlier era. We're talking 50 years ago. But, hey, I like those songs, and I hope you do, too. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. What is my name anyway? Norris, that's it, Robert Norris. And in the studio with me is Chris and Mike. They actually are both here. I think what I'm going to do is, I guess let's run through a little bit of your Occupy experiences, Chris. You said you occupied eight cities in the Occupy movement in 2011 and 2012, or 2011, I guess, probably is when it was.
Actually, you know, I'm being somewhat inaccurate with that, because actually the Atlanta movement I didn't see until maybe 4 or 5 months after my other involvement. Surprisingly, though, I found it was one of the only places in the country that still had a functioning and efficient Occupy. If anything, I would actually like to talk about them first, because that is the positive experience of Occupy I had being in Atlanta. They actually coordinated all of the activist groups in their city and have one meeting space, and they all, you know, every activist group essentially considers themselves their own occupier thing, you know. And it's beautiful. That's what we tried to do in New York City and found to be completely impossible. At least in part because of sabotage, I think. Not even necessarily federal agents, also just wing nuts, which the Occupy movement really, really made it possible for wing nuts to not only get on a podium, but so that no one can take them off of that podium. You know, they have every bit as much right to speak as anyone else, which is in the spirit of the Occupy movement. It was also very damaging, you know, looking back in retrospect and just being honest about what went on. And Atlanta was pretty well exempt from that. They're on the fourth floor of the homeless shelter in a pretty bad part of town, but you're kind of respected walking in there. Like, the people that interact with people normally, once they recognize that you were going into that building, they pretty well leave you alone, you know? Because they, at least some of them, appreciated what they had done in the community for homeless people there.
Well, you weren't occupying any public space. You were inside a private space, so I'm not sure what you were occupying in Atlanta at that point.
Well, it was still under the banner of the Occupy movement, definitely.
Indoors, privately. It's not... a banner is one thing, a reality is another. But
right. Well, I still feel like, even if they're not publicly occupying a space in a park, the forum that they have maintained there to this day, as far as I know, I've talked to a couple people from there semi-recently, not every city has actually maintained that forum. You know, in New York City, towards the end, Occupy became a very closed circle kind of thing where people would hold meetings and GAs and not tell anybody, not report where they were going to be until maybe an hour or so beforehand. They would do everything they can to keep what they considered undesirables, i.e. the people staying in the camps, from actually being able to attend the meetings. And that was definitely a very big part of my experience in Occupy in any city that I visited, is the divide between the people actually staying in the camps and the people living in houses and visiting meetings.
Were there camps in Atlanta they were staying in while they were having these meetings on the fourth floor of the homeless center?
No. During the movement...
So there was no division. There was just a bunch of people meeting indoors under the banner of Occupy who weren't occupying anything anymore.
Basically, yeah. Well, there were still... more than one action a week going on. I was actually.
What kind of actions did they do in
Atlanta? Well, when I was there, what I personally was.
And when was this, by the way?
I don't have my journal from last year, so I couldn't tell you the date on it. But the event that I'm going to tell
last
you
last year, 2013.
Last year, yeah. So, was it last year? Yeah, I believe it was last year, yeah. No, it was actually 2012. It was not last year, I'm sorry.
Okay. Was it like late 2012?
For the last time now, I have righted my memory. It was in January of 2013. This is shortly after, I believe it was the head lawyer of Monsanto became the president of the FDA, which the FDA headquarters, of course, is in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And I was there at a protest that drew maybe eight or so protesters in such a very large city. And it was for the law or the ruling that the FDA passed that they do not have to label genetically modified animal products and that they don't require testing, because that was when the first GMO animal product was introduced, which was the salmon, or as we call it, the Frankenfish.
And what happened? What was the nature of the protest?
Just your general picketing and passing out flyers, and we were standing in front of the FDA headquarters, of course, but I consider that to be such a meaningful action. I thought we would get more community involvement out of the people there, and frankly, nobody really cared.
I think Santa Cruz has had a similar situation.
I mentioned this earlier, that is the sentiment of most of the country, is kind of, we can't do anything about it. If we try to, people were abducted in New York City. There's a lot, things were worse there than in a lot of places, because a lot of the internet stuff was going on there, and some of that was directly considered terrorism. And, it's scary. It's scary out there. If you were actually in the camps and in the streets doing this, and you were there getting beat up by the police, it makes you think twice. And
this is why a lot of people refer to modern American society as a police state. They have all these rules and these fear laws. It's different in France, where people in the United States are being dumbed down more and more through lots of different modes, education and too much television and lots of other things. In France, everyone demonstrates. It's different. So what is going on here in the United States? What's happening? Why are we being dumbed down so much?
I think that complacency is usually a direct indication of stupidity. I'm just going to leave that statement where it lies. And
well, that's the same thing as being dumbed down. Stupidity is right. Another name for being dumbed down. Like you were saying, there's these very harsh police laws, basically.
Let's get back to the Occupy movement here to find out. Well, I mean, listen, Mike, you have some experiences that you want to talk about in terms. I hate doing the nostalgia thing. I'm not really interested, unless it bears on the present situation. Although I'm a big history buff, so I got a lot of contradictory thoughts here, but. The Occupy movement recently had a victory, I guess, They're still in the media as they try to prosecute people who are in New York City who are essentially peaceful activists, but who were being tarred and feathered as non-peaceful activists. And I think that there was recently a story about that, which I was going to read, but as usual, the clock is ticking, and I'm more concerned about stories here in Santa Cruz, frankly, because you can find out about, go to the Counterpunch website, look up the last few days, and you'll find a story about an activist who has got severe sentencing. The woman got severe sentencing, even though what happened was she was essentially attacked from behind by a cop. She elbowed the person, not knowing who it was, and they accused her of a felony assault on a police officer. And it was the jury, I think, was scandalized by the judge's sentence. But we have a similar trial coming up in a week. At least it'll be announced in a week with the Santa Cruz 11, the final four of the Santa Cruz 11, who again came out of the Occupy movement. I was one of the 11 until the charges were dismissed because for lack of evidence. As they should have been from the very beginning. But again, this seems to be a nationwide attempt to repress the Occupy movement. And I see that happening everywhere. I see it continuing here. And our little efforts to sort of stand up against that came up again Tuesday night at City Council. But the best way, I think, to introduce that is to, and feel free, guys, to comment on any of this stuff as we proceed with it. Here is some tape, because I still use tape, from a meeting of the Red Church 3 days ago, where I have been going, along with other members of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, to let people know when the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union's Board of Directors locally is meeting, when the City Council is meeting. Usually it's either the same day or the next day, so it's really kind of convenient for people who are homeless who have concerns, or more convenient, to go directly from there to three or four blocks to the City Hall or to the ACLU meeting at Loudoun Nelson. So, for example, next Monday, there's going to be another meeting of the Board of Directors of the American Civil Liberties Union. And yesterday at the HUF meeting, the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting that you two were at, all of us were at, we expressed the concern that while the ACLU has finally gotten together a resolution asking for a moratorium on nighttime camping bans in Santa Cruz, it has declined so far to make this a public statement, and it has also declined to take it to the City Council or the Board of Supervisors. And that's, as I understand it, the pretext is they want to clear it with the regional or the national organization first. The dynamic reality in the organization may be that the chair, Peter Gelblum, is hostile to the idea of the resolution and wants to stall it as long as he can. I don't know. I haven't talked to Gelblum, and I'm just speculating, but I've noticed how he treats people in meetings, me particularly, and so I'm not too optimistic or too sanguine about him. In any case, this Monday there was a city council meeting the next day, the last city council meeting of the summer when the city council goes on vacation for 6 weeks, and they'll be resuming their stuff in September. And they didn't have anything particularly exciting on the agenda. I think they have a Cowell Beach curfew that they want to resume, part of the needle hysteria that right-wing groups have been using to essentially focus on attacking homeless people as a way of a political platform for climbing to power, as far as I can see, but also a real concern they have that is based upon real bigotry and real paranoia, which is fine. That's their point of view. You know, I'm not going to force them to be medicated under Laura's law and send needles on wheels to their house to help them get over their antisocial behaviors toward poor people in the society. They have the right to their opinions, as hopefully we do have the right to our opinions. Of course, the minute you start to enforce your opinions with real action, that's when you start getting crushed, as the Occupy movement began to find once you really actually occupy areas.
Well, what interested me so much at the time of the Occupy movement was actually the national, the federal government response to the protests. They treated it almost as if it were an invasion of enemy forces. You know, they created laws to deal with protesting on a federal level. I believe it was, I don't want to say the wrong number. I want to say H.R. 347, which was the one that made it illegal to protest within, I believe, 1,300 feet of anyone who was protected by the Secret Service. Not only illegal,
I think I heard about that. Was that actually used, enforced against any occupied people?
I never heard of a case of it being enforced, but it was scary. It was scary to hear that that was the case, because how do you know if there's a guy in a restaurant who...
Yeah, of course. On Tuesday, however, when the city council met, we had encouraged people the day before to sign a petition at the Red Church to oppose, well, we asked people to support legalized camping zones. And there's currently a movement called the Sanctuary Camp, which, interestingly enough, also came up at the city council, not on the agenda, but, again, all this happened during the special doghouse oral communications period, a tiny period of time set aside for the public to come in and grunt a bit before they get sort of shoveled off into the back. And I call it a doghouse period because the mayors successively have moved that period from the beginning of the city council meeting at the important 7 o'clock session to the end of the city council meeting in the afternoon at a 5 o'clock time, usually when most people are gone from the city council session. I guess the claim for this is they want to save this city money by having the staff not have to sit through a half hour of public testimony from people who don't get to say what they say on any agenda item, because they can't get their agenda items on the agenda. The most obvious agenda items, rent control, police abuse, concerns about poor people, rising prices of food and housing, none of this gets dealt with in any local way or discussed, although it could be, regardless of the fact that it's a national trend. The fact is there are local things that can be done about these things and local positions that can be taken. And often national trends can be altered by actions at local levels. But that doesn't happen. In Santa Cruz, in some respects, there were, you know, Santa Cruz has taken some steps. The one of the first medical marijuana laws was passed in Santa Cruz. It was an advisory resolution in 1993, about the same time as San Francisco's, maybe a little afterward,
which essentially demanded the right to use medical marijuana. And immediately thereafter, Medical Marijuana Club, the famous Maple Street Club, opened up in Santa Cruz. And it was there ignored by the police for 2 years because there was a community support for the idea that you should have access to medical marijuana, obviously, since it has a lot of beneficial qualities and a lot of people use it. And it's just complete, sort of like a religious bigotry and a pseudo-scientific hostility to it that has nothing to do with real concerns. And ironically, that's the same time free radio opened up. Free radio also began, well, it actually predated free radio, but we began in the same building that the Medical Marijuana Club was in at the corner of Maple and Cedar Streets, for those of you who know Santa Cruz. And that's kind of interesting to me. Anyway, let's hear something from homeless people, not just or travelers like yourself, Chris. Actually, in this situation, for the first time for a while, the homeless vagabonds seem to outweigh the housed responsible speakers in my studio. Of course, I am the responsible guy, and you two are the vagabond kings, so we've got to watch out here. You can redress the balance by calling in at 831-427-3772. Don't let the homeless take over the town. Call in now if you can. Let's stop this before it gets too far. All right, so let's hear a little bit from these homeless people and their activities. Again, this is Monday at the Red Church. And this is an African-American guy who was very passionately, actually I only tuned in at the end of his speech, should have been there earlier because he had a lot of good and important things to say, but you're catching a few of them. Again, this is, you can catch any of this every Monday if you come to the Red Church between 5 and 7. And I think on Thursday it happened, too. I don't think you got to it today, though, did you, Mike? No.
That I can park and nobody's going to wake me up in the middle of the night when I'm not doing anything but back behind, so I'm just trying to sleep. You're tripping if I'm on the street. You're tripping if I'm in the parking lot. Okay, which one do you want? I'm trying to be out your way. I'm as far out your way as I can, and here comes the first alarm around the corner. Okay, that's what they think. That's what they think about you. And the people that are showing the grace to come in here and let us eat or care about us, okay, and feed us, in their lives, I'm telling you, the majority of people in their lives both would not do it and are fearful for them and concerned, and a lot of them think they're crazy.
And yet they do it.
Yeah, I got another thing to say.
Yeah.
Oh, right,
that
car.
That's bullshit.
I was saying, where's Robert? I'm standing behind Robert looking for Robert.
Under the heading of, do you want me to sleep in the parking lot?
By the way, is
So I think a lot of what both of you have said is, you know, it's right on, and it comes from the voices of people who are out there. I'm not homeless. I just work on this issue because I think it's a civil rights issue that concerns me.
That's it.
So
thank you.
And but you are out there. You're feeling this every night. You're feeling this every day. You feel it all the time. People's eyes are upon you, and it's you know, I can't even really, I can imagine it because I do stories. You know, I run around with my tape recorder doing that kind of stuff, getting your accounts and passing them on. But because you're the ones who are feeling it, you're the ones who have to fight it. And that's the hardest.
What I'm saying.
That is the hardest because you're also the most vulnerable. You're the people they can, you know, they can pick out, they can single you out, they can harass you unless you start getting together. And that is even harder because it involves trust. And it involves, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's homeless crime on crime that goes on. People are desperate. They take what they need or what they feel they need. It happens all the time. But the basic issues remain. There's no legal places for people to sleep in Santa Cruz. There's no legal places to store your stuff. in Santa Cruz. You don't have equal rights with the rest of the citizenry to enjoy the parks, the sidewalks, and the general public space.
Dogs can defecate on the beach and you can't sleep on it. Dogs can go in restaurants and you can't use the bathroom. That's the truth.
And there are no bathrooms at night except for one porta potty over there on Laurel Street and another one at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I call it. And they close up the bathrooms at night.
At 10 o'clock now.
Yeah. So tomorrow night there's a city council meeting that happens every 2 weeks, though they're going on vacation until September after this meeting tomorrow. But I encourage people, if they feel like they want to do it, to come to city council at 5 o'clock or 4:30 actually tomorrow. And the reason I say that is not because they are going to listen to you. They won't. They'll nod, they'll look like they're listening, but they're not listening to you. They don't give a shit, frankly. Their interest is in their constituencies that have money and in the people that come and shake cans of needles at them. That's the people they concern about, the Take Back Santa Cruz people. But if you start going and more people start coming and you start meeting each other and getting together the way you're getting together here as a community, that may ultimately have some impact. Tomorrow also there are a couple things happening. Some people are going to give speeches about the rights of homeless people. Here's a petition: legalize survival sleep campgrounds. This is not specifically about Sanctuary Village, which is also coming up. It says right now they need to legalize places for people to sleep, not at some ideal spot in the future where 100 people who have been cleared for drugs and alcohol and everything else can get in and there's a fence around it and a security guard. No. They need legal places right now for people to sleep. And because people are sleeping right now. And if enough people got together and slept together, they would have a lot of problems and they eventually would have to open up those places. That's what happened in Portland, Oregon. But it's easy for someone like myself who lives indoors to say this, because I don't face the tickets, I don't face the citations, and I don't face the harassment that you all do. So that is a reality for everybody here. I'm just bringing it up. But go to city council if you want. Tell them at the oral communications period, that's 4:30 tomorrow. There'll be people meeting outside. 5 o'clock tomorrow, they actually start the oral communications. They let you speak for 2 or 3 minutes during that period, depending on what... And this is at City Hall, which is right across from the main library, if you know where the library is. The actual address is 809 Center Street. It is across from the Civic Auditorium. Yes, there is also a church across from a library. That's on one corner. The City Hall is on the other corner. Yeah. And so again, I encourage people to think about that. Take Back Santa Cruz people are coming to City Hall tomorrow as well to argue against a sanctuary campground. Not that the council has a sanctuary campground in mind. It's just Take Back Santa Cruz is frightened that they might at some point. So I received an email today from Stacy Falls asking that people come to support a sanctuary campground. I'm on the fence a bit about a sanctuary campground. I think it's not a bad idea, except it's too limited. I think the approach is too legalistic, but still, any attempt to eliminate the sleeping bans, as the ACLU suggested 2-3 weeks ago, and people came to city council to talk about 2 weeks ago, any attempt to establish legalized campgrounds is a great idea. And a more important attempt to leave people alone outside is the real issue for me right now. Housing is vital. You know, support programs are great, but in the meantime, leave people alone is how I look at it.
Yes, sir.
So, if you're interested, come tomorrow and open up the bathrooms. You know, in the meantime, right, and the question is, why are we looking to them? We're not. They're not going to do shit. But what we have to do is, we're speaking really to the community. The community, this is a televised thing that's happening. They have a televised audience. And therefore, you can there express what's happened to you specifically in ways the Sentinel will never report, you know, the Good Times doesn't care about, and you're not going to get out on the normal radio stations. I put it out on free radio a bit. But, you know, this is a chance where people are watching television to get that information. Yeah.
Are they just letting us do this to appease our ass, or are they actually listening?
They're not listening.
It's going to make a difference.
The difference it makes is not with the city council. It's with the community and with people who get together and start deciding they have more power, that everybody is in the same situation. Everybody thinks they're all alone. They have to make their own private deal. No, it's a community situation where everybody is impacted by this.
Every movement, so all of us together, the better it's going to work.
And Becky wants to say, to remind you that if you haven't known already, free radio is back on the air if you listen to it. It's at 101.3 FM.
I do interviews. I'll be going around with my tape recorder asking you what's going on. And you can tell me if you want. We might be able to have some food there tomorrow, but it's not for sure. So don't come for the food. Come if you think you want to, you know, tell the community. I don't mean the city council because they don't give a shit, but you talk to the council and the television camera watches.
Yeah. So what you're really talking to is the broader homeless community. That's my suggestion. That's my thought. Also, call into free radio. I'll leave some cards here on the table in case you want the. Most of you may already have them, but this is there's a number you can call to talk about your experiences.
Where's free radio broadcasting from?
A secret location locally. Yeah, that's where it's from. Becky, you want to say something?
I really encourage you to come tomorrow to the Santa Cruz City Council at 4:30. We're gathering there, but really, realistically, it'll be closer to 5 when we'll be allowed to speak during the oral communications section of the meeting. You're going to be speaking to it's televised. The meetings are recorded. They are posted on the city's website, so you can go back to them, and you can get the video of that council meeting where you spoke, seize the link of it, and you can post that anywhere you want in the future, and let people. So your message can be amplified and amplified and amplified, but just keep at it. Don't give up. You know, you have to find the courage every minute of the day to keep going and keep fighting and keep that moral, ethical sense inside of you that every one of us has. And we interpret it differently. But if we don't follow our own internal moral code, we will be very, very unhappy with ourselves. So think about that when you're acting. You have to act courageously. You don't know if you're going to win or lose. We've had a lot of losses. Many attempts and lots of losses. But we're right, and they're wrong, and we will win. We just have to not stop.
Thank you.
Bob?
Thank you.
I don't know if any of you know me. Thanks, little sister. I don't know if any of you know me. My name is Bob Noxious. Check it out, man. We're putting it on a little thing around for you.
And before we hear Bob Noxious, I want to say that was Becky Johnson, who's a longtime activist and writer on homeless issues. Very few people came to the city council the next day, to be candid. I almost didn't go. I'd have preferred not to go. I don't like going to city council. And also, I face potential arrest for tape recording there unless I do it from an inaudible position or don't do it at all or have somebody sitting next to the tape recorder throughout the entire period of time for no explicable or legitimate reason. And so I usually have to do something with that ridiculousness. And I do, and I did, and we're going to talk a bit about that. If not today, then on Sunday when I do a longer show. By the way, you are tuned to Free Radio, in case you just tuned in. That was the recording of some discussions, speeches, actually, at the Red Church, which has its Monday meal every Monday from 5 to 7, and also Thursday at 4. And there's also opportunities to meet people of like mind and get some free food at the Food Not Bombs meal Saturday and Sunday, again at 4 o'clock, this time at the main post office. The Red Church meals are at Cedar and Lincoln Streets, right across from Jack's Hamburgers, Farmer's Market area, if you're familiar with that. So let's hear some more. And now we're going to you'll shortly be hearing some interviews. People stand in line waiting for food. I go from person to person saying, anything you want to say to the community. And sometimes people do.
The sign, legalize camping and shit, right? You don't sign it, me and my friends will kick your ass, period, the end. So sign it.
No coercion.
What we had was a petition to establish legal campgrounds. I think we got about 10 or 15 signatures, mostly illegible signatures. And I haven't yet presented them to City Council, but indeed it's a way of expressing people's opinions and giving people a chance to do something small and indeed ineffectual in a way at this particular point. But eventually you would hope this will lead to other actions as people begin to realize that together they have much more power than they do, just like, you know, the infamous stick of wood metaphor. You can easily break one or two or three sticks of wood individually. You put together a bunch of them and it's really hard to break. And it's same is true. That's why unions can be powerful and mass movements can be powerful. So, let's hear some more.
Finally, the last thing I wanted to say is the American Civil Liberties Union meets next Monday again, two blocks away from here. And Steve Plage, who is this tall, handsome-looking guy with a T-shirt, is the vice chair of the ACLU. He needs to hear from you about getting the ACLU on board with protecting the right of people not to have their property taken by the police, not to have their campsites dispersed. The city council, at least some members of the city council, listen to the ACLU, so you've got to talk to Steve and tell him to get these issues on the agenda for next week. So when you get when he butters your bagel, you can butter him up. That's my suggestion.
And in the past the past few months, I've been pretty regularly critical of Steve, who has been the vice chair of the ACLU now for at least a year, maybe longer, on the board of directors for 3 years, and has declined, except more recently, to bring resolutions forward that had anything to do with homeless people's rights, which has pissed me considerably. However, finally, there was a resolution that was brought forward, as you know, those who listen regularly, the moratorium on all camping laws, city and county, during the night, for at least for a period of time, for as a so-called trial balloon. I think it's kind of half-assed, but it's better that than nothing. And I've noticed also Steve has been posting more stuff about homeless civil rights. He's a lawyer, although I don't know if he's licensed to practice law specifically in California, or if he's licensed, he hasn't been doing it, or he's been working as a paralegal. It's always been a little obscure to me what his credentials are. But he, you know, he formed something called the Homeless Legal Assistance Project, and he's been posting stuff more recently about homeless civil rights. And he's got a few wrong ideas, in my view. One of them is this notion of homeless courts, which is a way of saying plead guilty, throw yourself in the mercy of the court, admit you're crazy, drunken, and a real problem, and we'll help you beat all your tickets. Instead of saying, what the fuck are you doing ticketing us for survival behavior and treating us as second-class citizens? And I can understand how some people despair of trying to assert the most basic rights because it seems futile to do that against the massive juggernaut machine, which is the police, the probation department, the courts, the collusive social service agencies, which aren't really in the main helping homeless people assert their rights, but rather want them to deny their rights so that they can get more funding to act as the intermediaries, medicalizing people, suggesting that they aren't fully competent to deal with their situation. It's not really a housing crisis. It's all the individual fault of each particular homeless person who has a drug problem or an alcohol problem. And many people do have these problems who aren't housed and homeless. But if you're homeless, you may be more likely to have such problems because you got to medicate yourself one way or another. Some folks, anyway, who do, and that's the experience they have. In any case, I keep beating the drums for basic civil rights on these issues, and we'll probably continue to do so. And now you can hear, coming up on Monday, we asked Steve, I directed people to talk to Steve Plaich about these issues, and maybe he did get some people to talk to him, although he hasn't spoken to me about it, and does not call into the show regularly, though he has, on occasion, spoken at length on this show. And we'll see what happens next Monday at the ACLU meeting, which I believe will be open to the public for 10 minutes. Unless you kick down $10 or $5 to the ACLU, at which point you become a member, and supposedly, although these rules seem to change from meeting to meeting, the right to sit through one of their board meetings, why anyone would bother, why I bother to talk about it, it's a mystery to me, but I do it anyway. In any case, that's happening next Monday at 7 o'clock at Loudoun Nelson Center. But this Monday, we get to hear some more, this last Monday, from the people who were expressing their feelings and talking about their experiences.
And we're out here talking with...
It's a newly revised old one.
And who is this who's speaking?
It's Mama Shannon.
Go ahead, babe.
The little boy waves high as the train goes by, and we all wave back, sitting on our asses in the grasses, waiting for a bowl of soup, a shower, or just a chance to fucking relax for an hour. And the train goes clickety-clack. And that boy's parents turn to him, and they say, those people should be ashamed, always asking us for change. You don't want to be nice to them. They're not your friends. And my friend goes into the tunnel to find his own track, and the train goes clickety-clack. And those tourists, they ain't done nothing for me, but laugh at what they see, adding to my misery. And my friend, he finds his track, and that train goes clickety-clack. And those tourists, they don't know what it's like to have all your shit fall off your bike and not know where you're gonna fucking sleep tonight, to ride all over town to meet with someone who says they're gonna help you get up off the street, and find they're out just not, and find they're just not there now. They don't know. Who's supposed to help you get off the street and find they're just not around, get you down, and my backpack, it's fucking heavy. And my friend, he was always around, picking me up when I was down, hugging me, or just playing the clown. But when I see him now laying across the tracks, I know he ain't ever coming back. And I hear the train go clickety-clack. And as they put him in the ground, I don't see those tourists anywhere fucking around. And the train keeps going clickety-clack. And my friend, he ain't never coming back.
Thank you, Mr. B.
And that was Shannon Breeden, Mama B, giving a poem. I think that she wrote that poem 10 years ago, and she's written poems since, often very striking poems. In the studio with me, and about to leave because he's being ignored for a tape, something I've often been advised not to do with live guests in the studio, but do anyway to their chagrin and my shame. And Chris has asked me if there's any questions I have for him before he hits the road.
Take your time. I'm in no rush.
I mean, you know, I my problem is I'm trying to squeeze a lot into this hour, and you're one of the things I squeezed in. I do tend to focus on the local scene. Anything else you've seen in Santa Cruz that you want to comment on, I guess, is one question.
Definitely, yeah. This falls under the category of being a national trend. However, I have had incidences, one that we discussed at the meeting yesterday, where the police have come up and attempted to harass me, and I have basically told them the rules in the area that I'm in, and then quite clearly that I'm not breaking them and I'm not going to leave, and they've walked away, and they've went on to other groups of people and instead started harassing them, hoping that they'll be ignorant of the law.
Talk about the specific instance that happened.
There's the one I brought up, the one that is the most clear-cut case of this, definitely, is the one I brought up yesterday, which was the day before, and I believe it was the day before, and this older blonde woman who was a police officer had kicked us out of one spot. We were sitting sort of near the boardwalk in an area that was just grass on the side of the road. You know, it was clearly no one's property, and we were sitting there and doing what homeless people do, resting and conversing, you know. And she came up. And
how many were you?
There was a good group of us. There's about 8 of us, which is apparently a reason to be harassed here. Definitely, being in a group of 8 people is a problem. Mm-hmm. So,
Were you blocking the sidewalk?
No, there was no sidewalk.
Were you smoking Mary Jane?
No, there were some beers open. A couple people got caught with beers, though. That was definitely there. So there was a legal grounds.
Were you panhandling in a group of two?
No, we were not panhandling at the time at all.
Were you sitting near a building within 14 feet?
We were not on any kind of
within
property.
14 feet of a fence?
Nope.
14 feet of an intersection?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, ho.
There
so
we
you
go.
Were criminal behaving. Go ahead. Tell me more about your crimes.
So we went to the boardwalk, and as my friend and I do, we split up for him to play the guitar and for me to juggle. And she came, and she told me that we were making the place look like a bunch of people are sleeping there. And I asked what crime I'm committing.
So you were juggling while sleeping? Was that
apparently
her concern?
I was juggling while sleeping, and I had had three or four people's packs. You know, everything was inside of the bags. There's nothing laying out. There's
so
no
you were acting as
around.
A makeshift storage person.
I was.
But you didn't have a license to store their property, did you?
I didn't, no.
No, you didn't. Nor did you ask for the permission of the local community nearby.
Well, apparently, though, this is no crime because I was allowed to continue doing what I was doing.
Well, maybe so. She was busy and we had to deal with other homeless trolls causing troubles.
Another incident that really struck me is when one of my friends that I was traveling with that I've separated from now, including the guitar kid, he got a ticket for smoking on the boardwalk, right? And as the cops were writing him the ticket, some people that were clearly not homeless walked by and they were all smoking cigarettes. And the cops said, hey, you can't do that here. And they walked by, and they continued smoking, and they walked by puffing their cigarettes. But it seems more like, if you're homeless, you can't smoke on the boardwalk.
They didn't give them a ticket.
They didn't give them a ticket, no. So there's definitely some selective
enforcement. Did you make a citizen's arrest of those smoking, Mr. Chris?
I did not attempt to, no.
Well, you see, now there you are. You're expecting the police to do your job for you. Yeah, that's the problem with you homeless people. You expect everybody to support you, and you just want special treatment all the time.
Of course.
Uh-huh.
I'm a king among men.
So, anything else about these incidents that struck you?
You know, the general theme is simply that there is a directive not only for the security and the people in the yellow shirts, but also for the police themselves.
You're talking about our hosts?
Our hosts.
Our hostile fatality people?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
they're there to make you feel more comfortable.
Oh, and so comfortable they've made
mm-hmm.
me feel.
Yeah, well,
and you know, I can't say that I've had bad experiences with those people. I won't say anything bad about the yellow shirt people or the
I'll industry. Do that for you.
Well, thank you. But
get a job, you clowns! Go ahead.
Do something that actually helps people.
That's
but,
right. Stop harassing poor people.
Exactly.
Thank you.
And that's the thing, is they seem to only really exist to harass the homeless that are in their area. And the police seem to be, like, under some kind of directive to go out and harass the homeless because they check the parks and the sleeping areas in the mornings and roust people. And, you know, again, this is a national trend. I've seen this in a lot of cities that try
I don't want to hear that it's a national trend again. I may have to beat you if you get that.
Well, here in Santa Cruz...
It's like saying, you know, fascism is a national trend. We have to, you know, I've got to go with the flow here. No, we don't.
We don't. Not in any way whatsoever.
No, thanks.
But I think it's important to understand that this isn't just a concern here, that this is something coming down from higher up. You know, this comes down to urban planning and to the
I don't think the city manager or the city council or the mayor or the police chief are directed to do this by other agencies. I think this is homegrown bigotry. Although, I see, I mean, I'm sure you're right, it's happening in different places. You know, and it's empowered by the, you know, the bogus terrorism war and drug war that is, you know, essentially stripped everyone of their constitutional rights, except they just don't know it yet.
Well, you know, I've had the experience in my travels of knowing some fairly affluent people, and something I've learned about them is that they are more aware than the poor people of the fact that a case system exists, and they're very happy to tell you about what case they're from and what case you're from, and you know, the dynamics.
You mean caste?
Caste.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sorry. And the dynamics that are related to that. So I had the experience of knowing a gentleman in New York City who was a hedge fund manager and spending some time at his house. And he explained to me how as a child he was raised to know that poor people are dangerous because they want what you have and they'll kill you to take it from you.
Damn
you know?
Straight, man.
And, you know, I've seen that mentality in some of the people here because it hurts when I'm juggling and I'm entertaining. And someone's kid stops to watch me, like I mentioned earlier, and their parents like, no, you can't look at him. You know, he's dirty. Don't look at that man. Don't take entertainment from him because you'll be tainted by it and you'll become in some way like him, you know, and that's not allowed for you.
Might pick up his cooties.
Might pick up his cooties, yeah. And it's troubling, you know, to see that kind of mentality exists in 2014 in what is supposed to be academically and culturally kind of one of the centers of America, really, being here in California, you know, and supposed to be. And the experience that I have had here is definitely that there is a coordinated effort, whether or not it's ordered by an outside agency, there is a coordinated effort to harass to the highest extent possible by the law, and even to take it a little further if they can get away with it, to harass homeless people and sort of scare them out of town. And I'm told by the people that live here, and this is secondhand, that they don't really follow up those tickets a whole lot either, and they'll go away within a year. The tickets are essentially a fear tactic. You know, it's not that there's any real serious penalty behind them, or that they're going to extradite you, or that, you know, even they really care about prosecuting them. But I guess they figure if they give someone enough tickets, they'll leave. And, you know, I actually tried to leave, and I didn't get out on the highway, and I ended up meeting this new fellow I'm going to travel with. And so I'm kind of happy that things turned out the way they did, but they kind of got me. They scared me out of town, and I was ready to go, because I don't like the way things are here.
So a successful operation. I have to commend Police Chief Kevin Vogel for his good work. Also, however, you should be aware that some people do get deported back to Santa Cruz on the basis of these bogus tickets, though we're talking mainly about misdemeanor tickets. Once you get three infraction tickets, which you haven't attended to, that itself becomes a misdemeanor crime for which they can issue a warrant. And also, any subsequent infraction for the next, I think it's 6 months or year, gives you a misdemeanor, not just an infraction, every subsequent infraction of any kind. So it, and I think this is unconstitutional to the max. I don't think they can do this. It hasn't been challenged in court, but I'm not, you know, I don't have the legal sites. I'm not the expert on the issue. But I know that one of the things they're doing with their downtown accountability project, the DAP, or the Downtowners Against the Poor, as I like to call them, is they want to essentially, under the pretext of helping people with social services and drug reduction and treatment services, remove the people who are just the most either resistant to these fear tactics or oblivious to them. And those can be because people are, you know, don't fuck with me, buddy, kind of people, or, you know, I'm too drunk to fuck with. You know, you lose, even though, you know, it's... And it's something that people do not want to see in an urban area. I was a little... And I noted your own saying, you know, it interferes with my juggling act, man. How are the kids going to hang out with some boozer guy in the side?
Actively drinking on the street.
The boozer guy, just like, you know, the other fucking, you know, high-class boozers who are sitting in the cafes with their little cocktails, they get the privileges that, you know, they've enlisted you and their prejudices, unfortunately. And you have a problem that, you know, it is a real problem for you because you want to not just make money as a juggler.
You brought up an interesting memory for me. I don't know if this was a precedent. Well, I'm under the impression it was not a precedent because the judge allowed it, but I had in New York City, marijuana is decriminalized, and I had a ticket for smoking in public, and I got the ticket dropped because I told the judge, basically, it's legal to be in possession of marijuana and to smoke it if you have a home to smoke it in. And the same sort of situation exists with alcohol. It's legal for you to have alcohol and drink it if you can go in an establishment where you pay $10 a drink, or if you can take it home and drink it in your home. But if you're homeless, it's illegal for you to indulge. You know, there's a special anywhere at all. And even if I'm out in the woods in the middle of nowhere and it's late at night and nobody could possibly find me unless they are looking to find homeless people, the police will come out and look to find homeless people and pour your booze on the ground if you're dumb.
That's for your own good, son. And for the greater good of the community. You don't seem to understand. We don't need your kind around here.
That is the impression that I have been given, definitely.
Yes.
Both in my...
So the judge dropped the ticket?
The judge actually dropped the ticket.
However, you're...
There's also a very minor infraction there.
And also you were pretty articulate, and he probably didn't want to fucking bother with it.
Right.
You know, and he also wanted to appear nice to his liberal friends. However, probably for the next 43 cases that came up in the drug war...
He prosecuted them.
He probably, you know, did his usual good judge thing, which... ruined a lot of people's lives, probably, and that's that really is something you should remember when you see these clowns, highly paid clowns, coming out of the courts, who are either our attorneys or judges, is that they are the instrumentality by which people's lives are destroyed, and they have little to do with justice.
In some cases, they do have something to do with justice.
They usually agree with the police. The police who are prosecuting the case, they usually agree. You have very seldom find them disagreeing with the police's viewpoint.
Well, it's very important to have them testify, because the problem with the police is that they lie a lot in their reports, and they usually don't remember their lies. And so I also had another ticket that I beat in New York City by calling up the police for testimony. Now, this is ignoring the multiple tickets where the police didn't show up, and so those were dropped. But in this case, the police officer showed up, and what he wrote on the police report, and what the other two officers attending wrote in their police reports, and what he wrote in his journal that he brought into court to read off his notes that he took of the incident, none of those things matched in any way. And what it turned out to is that in none of those stories, even though all of them did not match, had I actually committed the offense of which I
was
accused. Which was sleeping in a park when, in fact, I was on the sidewalk outside of the park, and therefore the whole thing was moot to begin with.
And how many hours of your life did this entire event take, and not just the court, but, you know, going to the initial arraignment and so forth?
You know, I couldn't even tell you, because it's something that happened over like 6 or 8 months, involved, you know, my involvement with the National Lawyers Guild in New York City. I couldn't have done it without them, I'm sure. And
You had lawyers. You have lawyers in the other case, too?
I did. Well, actually, no. In the marijuana case, I did not.
Oh, okay.
That was purely my own.
It'll be nice if we had a National Lawyers Guild here who did shit. We don't. We actually, the only time they actually tried to do something more recently was with the Occupy movement. And even then, they couldn't find lawyers for the Santa Cruz 11 and weren't volunteering to do it, really. But the most activist lawyers, even among the Santa Cruz 11 lawyers, the most activist one is Alexis Briggs, who's the lawyer for Cameron Lorando, who most people don't know in Santa Cruz because he doesn't live here. My
experience with the National Lawyers Guild, of course, has been almost entirely in New York City, but my experience with them is that they are definitely interested in their own ambitions more than they are in actual political activism. So, like, they picked up my case because it was a major arrest. It was the one that I got the lawsuit settlement for.
Tell me about it.
It was the New Year's of Occupy, so the 2011-2012 New Year's, and we ripped down all of the barricades that were around Zuccotti Park after the raid to keep people out of the park and to prevent people from bringing back... You couldn't even bring a backpack in the park. You know, it wasn't allowed. If you were homeless, of course, tourists were allowed to bring their backpacks in, but that goes without saying. I was one of the people that actually very sneakily cut the zip ties, and we did this without the cops.
You vandalized the zip ties.
I did.
Now, that was done here in Santa Cruz when the police tried to surround an area where people were, the drum circle area, with a fence. And every time they did that, some person, often the same person, would come and unsnip it and put it aside and then, you know, roll it up for the police to take away, and people would again resume their drum circle. Now, of course, that area has been usurped by the a coffee joint that has been doing the thing at the farmers market every Wednesday in that area, and that has all been taken over by commerce. That has nothing to do with farmers marketing anyway. It's a sad thing. But go ahead.
So, continuing with the incident, so we very sneakily and without evading the police's notice, even right next to them, we cut all of the zip ties around the entire park. Zuccotti Park is fairly large. I'm not sure if either of you have ever been there.
Never.
It's a fairly large park, and it accommodated literally thousands of people during the... It was quite overcrowded, though, during the camp, but... we cut all of these zip ties, and then in a coordinated effort at midnight... For our celebration, we tore them all down and piled them up in the middle of the park. This got fairly violent. A lot of people got injured by the police. There is one point...
You mean the police got fairly violent?
Yeah, the police got fairly violent.
Are you
violent.
Saying that you attacked innocent civilians and the police moved in to protect those people?
Absolutely not. So, when actually... My most vivid memory of the violence at that point of the night was actually maybe 8 or so police officers picking up a barricade, and instead of pulling it back to the edge like they had done previously, we had sort of played tug-of-war over a number of the barricades, because, of course, there's a very heavy police presence. These guys actually charged forward with it and trampled a number of people. One kid got his leg broken at that point.
Was it on camera?
Some of this was on camera. Of course, the police in New York City were notorious for taking people's phones and cameras and smashing them on the ground in front of you. Which is why we started live streaming. This is how the policy of live streaming started, because then they can't take your video away.
I think it's a program called Zip or something that puts it on the internet
right away.
Right
on the internet, right. And so that's why that policy started. I mean, during During the actual Zuccotti raid, it was reported in the Wall Street Journal that 16 mainstream news reporters, just counting the mainstream guys, were put in emergency condition in the hospital. You know, the police, they don't really follow the law in New York City because they're pretty much the mafia.
You don't mind, the police are the law.
They're also the mafia and the racketeering people and the biggest drug dealers in the city, but we won't go into all of that. So anyways, the police finally cleared everyone out of the park, got their barricades back. This took several hours. It was a madhouse. There were like 3,000 protesters there and maybe 500 police. And so they cleared most of the people out of the park, arrested a lot of people. A lot of people went home. And then this is where my part of the story comes in. We're marching down the street later that night. I don't remember exactly where we're marching to. It was somewhere in Soho and Lower Manhattan. And we got boxed in against a wall. There weren't a whole lot of us left at that point, 100 or so people. And we got boxed in against this wall and surrounded by the police. They actually set up barricades in some areas to make sure that none of us could move. And we were told on the megaphone that they love to use during protests that if we did not leave, we would be arrested. But we were not allowed to leave. And if we came towards them, they said that if you come any closer, I'm going to defend myself, basically. Like it's an aggressive action, you know, and people were actually beaten during this point. Now, I forgot to mention that earlier in the night, because this was a part of the lawsuit, earlier in the night during the barricade fiasco, I had been maced pretty heavily. And this is not the mace that police carry on their belt. This isn't the mace that comes with a big can with a big handle on the back, and it sprays a blanket of mace out into a crowd. And it's very, sticks to your skin. It's very volatile. It's nasty stuff to breathe in, definitely. There was a woman who had an asthmatic incident that night, I believe. But, you know, people with asthma were also told not to be there. But
they have only themselves to blame.
Yeah, right. Not the violence of the police. So, anyways, you know, it was pretty roughly handled that night. Had some bumps and bruises, was maced. And so then we were quite clearly illegally arrested. And this is why the National Lawyers Guild stepped in, because they like very clear-cut cases where, you know, we were surrounded. We were told we must leave, and then prevented from leaving, and then arrested for not leaving.
Same thing happened in Oakland, I believe, a month later.
And so this is what disturbs me. This is where I get a bad taste in my mouth out of the whole incident. The National Lawyers Guild observer, who was arrested in that crowd of people that was boxed in, within 2 months got a $32,000 lawsuit settlement. Right. Me, 2 years later, I'm asked politely by the National Lawyers Guild to take... I was expecting to get $15,000. I got $5,000. I was told to take this because my criminal record would be used against me to say that my time in jail was irrelevant because I had already been incarcerated multiple times before. And so this is apparently a standard in civil law that if you have been incarcerated, your time in jail is not worth as much money because the indignity of being kidnapped and illegally detained is bearable for you. You've already endured it before.
Well, you're clearly a criminal, so we need to, should we say, cut back on the perks you seem to be getting at the expense of the general community. You types who go to the lawyers, who get most of the money anyway, you know, are truly sucking the tit of the public will meal. Anyway, you know, it's interesting. Do you have more to say about that particular incident?
A little bit more. So anyways, there's definitely a double standard legally. You know, a National Lawyers Guild observer, a National Lawyers Guild legal observer is worth $32,000 for maybe 30 minutes in jail. And a guy who is a felon is worth $5,002 for more than 24 hours in jail. And, you know, that's a disturbing sort of incident. And even, you know, in a sense, it was a victory. The NYPD and the city actually admitted to a number of things that are going to be used in further cases down the line in taking my settlement. So, you know, I made some progress, but it leaves, all in all, a very bad taste in my mouth. Because I was told by the system that the suppression of my First Amendment right of free speech, the continual persecution of the Occupy movement in every city in the country, that being told to shut up isn't a big deal. You know, just kind of deal with it, basically.
Well, you can speak very loudly. Just go out in the country where no one can hear you.
Exactly.
It's very simple. We're talking with Chris here. You want to give your full name, Chris, or is that a secret?
Oh, it's no problem. Christopher Brannan, with two N's there, Brannan.
An Irish.
It is an
Irish rebel.
It is, in fact, a Saxon name after the Saxons were kicked out of their homeland and went to Ireland. So my father is Saxon and Irish.
Invading vicious Saxon dogs who murdered and pillaged the native Celts.
He did, in fact.
I'm sorry to hear that. I don't wish to get into that at this time. Probably it's, you know, chickens coming home to roost at this point.
Right.
So you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, on the line with us, or I should say in the studio with us, giving us their commie line. Or is it their terrorist line? Or maybe it's their riffraff line. Is Christopher Brennan and, of course, where's his credentials, Dr. Michael O'Grady, the so-called naturopath who is naturally very friendly, I must say, to say the least. The article that I did mention earlier about the latest discriminatory treatment of Occupy people, it's an article by Dave Lindorf, a known lefty, who writes, already abused by cops, court, and DA, Occupy protester trashed by New York's leading paper. And it reads a little bit as follows. You can catch it online at the Counterpunch website. When a journalist in a news article refers to a woman as strident, you know what you're reading is a hit piece, not a dispassionate report. And that's what the New York Times offered up to its readers in a piece about a court appearance by Occupy Wall Street activist Cecily McMillan. The Times reporter, Monique O'Madan, as a professional journalist, surely knows the meaning of strident and so forth. Supposedly, Milan was writing a news report on McMillan's appearance in a Manhattan criminal court on a misdemeanor charge of obstructing governmental administration. This related to an incident in 2013 in which she allegedly advised two people being ordered to show their identification to a transit police officer in the Union Square subway station that they did not have to comply. I actually had a similar experience at the Metro when a local Metro thug, I should say First Alarm security guy, I think it was First Alarm, went up to two homeless people and told them that they couldn't sit there, they couldn't be there, and so forth. And I said, you don't have to talk to them, you don't have to give your name, and you can sit there. And he said, okay, what's your name? And I said, no, what's your name? Let's see, I don't tell you my name, I'll only tell you my name, you tell me your name. And this went back and forth. And I eventually was, the police were called, I was convicted of trespassing in a public Metro facility. And why? Because I was blocking a Metro sign. This is a sign 7 feet long and 3 feet high. And I may be big, but there is a question as to whether I'm that big. But in any case, this idea that when you advise people of their rights, you become a target is, you know, something when people have to consider, particularly since I'm encouraging people to assert their rights and advise other people their rights. The best thing to do, as the two of you have suggested, is to have some kind of documentation while you're doing this. Because that often can drive off the police. If you have a camera, or if you look like you have a camera, they suddenly, the behavior begins to change.
The problem with asserting your rights with the police, and I've had this experience on the road before, is that, and I usually check the laws in the state before I enter it, but in more than half of the states, you don't have to show ID. In a little bit under half, you do. And if you are requested, if you are being detained, you must show ID, regardless, in any state, however. Now, I have told police before, basically, that I don't have to talk to them.
You don't have to show ID if you're being detained in California.
Really?
It's often advisable, and the ACLU advises you, if you are detained or questioned, to give your name and address. But you're not required to carry your ID around with you as you walk. That's just simply not required. It's not a crime to do that.
Right. Well, anyways, so I've had the experience of asserting my rights, and as a homeless person, it's very dangerous, because when you are on the highway and you tell one police officer, I don't even have to talk to you, can I go now? They call in more of their friends, and then they threaten you, and they basically tell you, you're not going to leave here if you don't cooperate. And this is there's some states where this is more dramatic. In Texas, they're literally in the newspapers for fucking killing homeless people. Also in New Mexico, where they shot the man in the back 6 times with an automatic rifle and then reported.
Oh, in Salinas, they've shot people. Is it four now?
Four.
Wow. They have 4 people in 3 months.
And
Salinas,
it's scary.
Is pretty close.
So, you're intimidated into giving up your freedom as an American and showing them the ID just so they'll go away. And the thing is if they're just going to go away after I show it to them, I'm not the person they're looking for. In the first place, it's just harassment. They want to document where you're going, where you're hitchhiking to and from.
It might come in handy later.
This is, again, a symptom of the police state, because the judges don't give out to the police. The police don't get enough criticism on the papers, and they can literally pretty much do as they damn well feel like. This is a symptom of our police state.
I was told by a friend of mine who was a police officer that in the academy, when they're taught how to talk to people on the street, they are more or less, not in quite the same words I'll use probably, but they are instructed to use people's ignorance of the law against them. If they can, you know, just in the fact that you're in a state where you don't have to present ID, and the first thing the police always ask you when they interact with you is to present ID. And then when you tell them they don't have to, they'll go on their little, I need to see your ID. I need to see, why do you need to see my ID? And this is something that they do anywhere that you go, and they are instructed to do it, actually.
Well, there is, of course, this sort of counter training that people have been using, or were using in Santa Cruz a few years ago, which is that if you are approached by a police officer, the first thing you say is, am I free to leave?
Right.
And if they say no, then you say, you know, well, am I under arrest? You're being detained. And then you say, well, then I don't want to say anything. I'd like to speak to a lawyer. It's as simple as that. And then you just sit down and relax. But, of course, if you're trying to get to your job or you want to get to a meal in one of the free meal lines or you want to just remain where you are without being harassed by the police, because for homeless people, you've got no home to go away to. You're just being driven from point to point and place to place. You want to find a way to be able to say, back off, you know, I'm trying to relax here and read this book. If you've got a crime or if I can help you with a problem you have, let me know. Maybe I'll do it. Maybe I won't. And I've often suggested on this show, the best thing to do when you're dealing with the police is don't answer questions. Ask questions. And don't be rude, and don't be abusive, and don't, unless you want to, of course, but, you know, you're dealing with an armed thug who's got the force of the law and the whole court system behind him and is trained to act in a macho way, so you have to be careful. But on the other hand, you have your own dignity to protect, and there's a really fine line sometimes between doing that.
And there's more than just my dignity. In fact, I got into some of the history of my last name, and I'm not going to elaborate too thoroughly, but I got on Ancestry.com and paid an arm and a leg to have my DNA tested and to trace my Brannan ancestors.
And you found you're one of them criminal Saxon dogs who came over.
Border lord is the term, thank you.
Border lord.
Border lord means we charge toll to travel places or kill you and rob you.
Charming.
Anyways, getting back to the American part of that history, my ancestors fought in both the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. So
on
both sides.
Oh, charming.
But
I would have preferred you were one of the Quakers, but that's...
So anyways, I feel very adamantly and passionately that as my ancestors were mountain men and traveled and tried to find their means in the ways that I do today, I have a right to be doing what I do. That right has been paid for in blood. And when I come somewhere like this to where people who I feel like aren't even really a part of this country, because that rich elite that feels as if they're in a separate caste from the rest of society, they don't interact with us and they don't do anything to enrich our society. They don't give us anything. They only ask.
How can you say that? The Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts have provided for libraries galore throughout the... haven't you ever heard of grants that they give to needy people and needy individual charities? You seem to have no respect for the wealthy in our country, son.
I'm sorry that I don't appreciate the little breadcrumbs that I chew off of the beards of those who deserve life on this planet. But as it stands, I feel very adamantly that in a country that claims to be the best place in the world to live and claims to be a free country, I should be able to walk down the highway without constant harassment, without being stopped by a police officer every 30 minutes or being told that you can't hitchhike on this highway because the shoulder's too thin, even though there's no law whatsoever that says that you can't hitchhike on a freeway in California. I checked.
But the entrance to a freeway, it's illegal to be on, I believe.
Well, I wasn't on the entrance when we got...
I see. Well, so you flew over the entrance, did you, Mr. Saxon guy?
They were so polite that even though they wouldn't let us get in the car that pulled over to pick us up, they would give us a ride back into town in the direction that we just came from so that we wouldn't be breaking the law on this freeway that we were legally allowed to be on.
And you have obviously no gratitude for this kind of thing. That's the problem with your kind, you Saxon types. So we've had here for the last 1 3/4, almost 2 hours, Chris and Michael O'Grady, and your endless phone calls, which have been ringing off the hook. So that's almost it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. I'll be back on Sunday with another edition of this. I'm going to kind of conclude by letting you know what I wasn't able to say, because these guys took up all the time on the air. So don't blame me. In fact, actually, I'm glad we have people talking about their own lives and their own experiences here. there was an interest. There's been a couple of interesting stories. One's been on Homeless Patch, which is a sort of a previously half-assed right-wing local news group that has now kind of lost its local guy, I guess, who they dropped him. He was one of he and his reporters, or mostly his reporters, were actually just as the Santa Cruz 11 were. They were in the building at 75 River Street, but they were never charged with anything. Just the reporters who were active lefties were charged, Bradley Stewart and Alex DeRosi, and me, and Brent Adams, and Becky Johnson. But however, the Santa Cruz Patch has a story, Homeless Sanctuary Crusaders plan to set the record straight at city council meeting. This would have been something I'll probably go into on Sunday when I'll be playing some of the city council meeting. Stacy Falls and Brent Adams did produce a series of responses to concerns, rabid accusations, actually, that have been made against the Sanctuary Campground proposal. And Santa Cruz Patch talks about there is a group that is opposing them, the Sanctuary Village, called STAB. I'm not quite sure what that acronym is stands for. Then, of course, there's Take Back Santa Cruz, which also... well, here, let's check out this story here. And if these people showed up at the city council, there's a story. Santa Cruz is about to make a horrible mistake on this website. STAB, Santa Cruz, tracking Santa Cruz County stabbings and crime since 2008. And I'm not going to bother to read this aloud until I've parsed it myself and reflected on the great wisdom that comes out of this website, if any. And, you know, I mean, it's important to know what those of different opinions think. So I'm going to be doing that, hopefully, before the Sunday show, which will be starting at 9:30 on Sunday morning. I'm also hoping to have on the air Robert Lederman, or Letterman, I'm not sure which, I think it's Lederman, who is who was the president of Artist, which is the organization that supports street performers and artists in New York City, and has been defending them for several decades and standing up to people like Giuliani. He was arrested repeatedly for distributing flyers of Giuliani with a Hitler mustache. Giuliani is a former mayor.
Oh, slander.
And, yeah. So, I don't know. I've not been able to contact him yet, but I'm going to try and get him on the air to talk. He has been interviewed on the show before. You can, if you look up Artist on the Huff website, if you go to the past archives of these shows, you can find the, you know, a lot of these old interviews, which I think are not, unfortunately, they're not as dated as they should be, because the same crap continues. There's a new report out by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty called No Safe Place, the Criminalization of Homelessness in U.S. Cities, which kind of goes through, as you were mentioning, Chris, the specific criminalization stuff that's happening across the country, and Santa Cruz apparently gets high marks for its anti-homeless stuff. Laws around camping in public, sleeping in public, begging in public, loitering, loafing, or vagrancy laws, sitting or lying down in public, living in vehicles, food sharing, storing personal belongings. And again, we're going to encourage people to try to kick the ACLU's ass into making some more public statements on this. Or, of course, ideally, and really the point, is to have homeless people join us in protests around the anti-homeless programs like the Downtown Accountability Project, or Downtowners Against the Poor, that has its office at 1101 Pacific Avenue. Unfortunately, that's a pretty big address. It has all kinds of different businesses at that address. But we're going to be having a protest there next Wednesday after the Huff meeting. We'll be serving brownies, coffee, whatever kinds of num-nums we can cook up, and encouraging you to come and make your thoughts known. We'll probably have some petitions. I've been trying to get information out of them as to how much money is actually going to go into housing programs and treatment programs, and how much is going into the salaries and leases and buildings. I think they're getting their stuff free, the buildings, but there is this and who is actually being targeted on by this program? Is the point to provide solutions for people, as they claim, or, and as Steve Plaich claims in his television presentation of this, which he's posted online, or is it, in fact, to round up the unsightly, the smelly, and others who are, should we say, best dumped somewhere far outside of town for the well-being of jugglers and middle-class merchants alike. And, of course, I support, unfortunately, I'm on the other side of that issue. I don't think they should be dumped outside of town, however difficult that may make jugglers and selling knickknacks downtown and the overpriced shops. So we'll be talking about that, and we'll be doing something about that in terms of direct action, hopefully, assuming anybody comes to the Huff meeting next Wednesday at 11. I'm going to play a little more from the Monday Red Church interviews, and we're going to segue into Uncle Dennis's from the Cream of the Dregs. He should be coming into the studio shortly. And I want to thank you both for being with us on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Michael, for coming in. And thank you all for listening, and let's hear a little more, and then I'll fade into the sunset. You can hear the music of creamy, dreggy Uncle Dennis.
Phone will be, again, that's been done at the tannery.
Called Train Tracks. Put a tattoo on my chest, took $20, bought a bag of heroin, and went into the tunnel and died 10 years ago.
Thank you. Well, you say there's been a puppy napping?
No. My buddy got it online from Craigslist, and his mom abandoned it. It's 3 weeks old, and that little puppy, he $30 for a thing of puppy formula, and he mixed it, and that thing just loves it.
Oh, so he's doing good.
Oh, heck yeah. He's
naming the puppy.
Oh, gosh. Where is he? I don't know where he went.
What's your name?
I'm David Johnson.
David, anything you want to say about anything else that's happening? That sounds like a positive thing, but anything else positive or negative?
Yeah, he got a ticket this morning for camping under the wharf, but he wasn't camping. He's wide awake. He had a puppy on his chest with a blanket over it. Not over him, just over his chest.
What time was it?
About 7 o'clock. And 32 minutes later, he got another ticket for the puppy being on the beach. The cop looked at the ticket, and he goes, hand it back to him. He goes, I'm writing you another one. For that little bitty puppy. I got the ticket, too.
Same cop?
Maggie, my dog. Yeah.
Same cop?
Yeah.
Name of the cop?
No. Actually,